So there's a term that's used most often in the financial world, but also in geopolitics. And the term is a black swan event. I don't know if you've all heard of this black swan event. Obviously, a black swan is extremely unusual. Almost all swans are white. But every once in a blue moon, which is also an unusual event, a black swan comes along. So this is a term that indicates a cataclysmic event that leading up to it was not predicted. Perhaps not predictable, except by maybe a very few people. But the vast majority of people can't see it coming and get blindsided. And this is called a black swan event. Now, these events usually have quite negative outcomes, at least not over the short term. Over the long term, perhaps not. It's one of these blessings in disguise situations. But initially, there's a reaction to a black swan event, and it can be quite epidemic. Reaction of, this can't be, or this is horrible, the sky is falling, the world's going to end. All these reactions that lead to very serious outcomes, like market crashes. We can remember one in 2008. The black swan event was the failure of Lehman Brothers. Suddenly, because of the junk mortgages and the over-leveraging by people with very poor loan risk over a large number of people, there was a sudden collapse. This apparently very strong edifice was seen abruptly to be a house of cards, and it fell apart. And the reaction was very swift, and it brought about a what they call the Great Recession. Well, we recently had a black swan event. We had a person who, for over a year, demonstrated himself to be a racist, a homophobe, a liar, a narcissist, basically just at least the way he presented himself, the way he appeared, to be a really, really horrible human being. And this person, about 10 days ago, 10, 11 days ago, just became elected President of the United States of America, Donald Trump. So once again, there was this reaction, mostly among those who didn't support him. The reaction was, this is kind of the end of the world, and what do we do now? And I can't believe this happened, and I didn't see it coming. And, you know, the opposition had a 98%, I think a day or two before the election, 98% chance of winning. So this all fits as a black swan event, because it wasn't predicted by the majority of people. And it had a cataclysmic outcome. Now, we don't know where it's all going to lead. But I'm using this really as an opening to discussing and going into depth on a fundamental aspect of our practice here, our mindfulness practice, our Zen practice. What is fundamental about it that enables us to see these events in a way that empowers us and that rescues us from a sense of despair and victimhood? So I thought perhaps as a way of shining down upon this circumstance, and I'm going to go into it a little further, I would read a koan from the Hekigan Roku. Now, just for the benefit of those who are rather new to the practice, the Hekkigan Roku is the most famous book in Zen Buddhism. Probably second most famous is the Mumon Kan. Now, in the West, the Mumon Kan, Gateless Gate, may be more well known, but throughout the world of Zen over the ages, the Hekkigan Roku, this Blue Cliff Records, this collection of 100 koan, or stories, that are deeply puzzling, highly challenging, but that illuminate fundamental aspects of our practice that can lead us to awaken to things that we didn't even suspect were there. This book is above and beyond all other so-called collections, put together by a Zen master named Yuan Wu. And this book of 100 koans, the 97th koan of which is the one I'm going to read now. It's right near the very end of the book. I want to just say one other thing about it. I've actually mentioned it in many other Taisho that I've given over the past few years, and I think even a couple of Taisho, it was the primary focus, and perhaps it is for this one as well. That may partly be something personal to me. I find myself quite often reciting it to myself silently as a way of correcting my mind. I find it highly valuable. I think that it shines a light on something so fundamental to this whole practice. And I'm going to read it now. So this is Case 97. And the title of it, and once again I should just mention before I go into it, keep you on tenterhooks a little longer, it refers to the Diamond Sutra. So we talked about the Hekkigan Roku. Hekkigan Roku is this most famous book of Zen. And I think arguably, one might say the Diamond Sutra is the most famous sutra in Buddhism, at least from the standpoint of Zen practitioners. So, the Diamond Sutra was a series of very short chapters, and each one went right to the heart of the matter. And it was a conversation between Buddha and one of his students. And it's about 32, 33 chapters long, but they're very, very short. So this one deals with a particular chapter in the Diamond Sutra. So the title of this koan from the Hekkigan Roku, koan number 97, is The Diamond Sutra and Being Reviled. The Diamond Sutra says, one who is reviled by others has done wicked acts in former lifetimes which doom him to fall into evil worlds. But because of the scorn and vilification by others in the present life, the transgressions in the former life are wiped out. I'm going to kind of leave this like a sliver of the supermoon, just a sliver, shining down on a pitch dark night, enabling us to perhaps not trip over objects that we otherwise would not have seen. As we go a little deeper into this, this thing about black swans being reviled, what might all be subsumed under the bumper sticker, shit happens. How do we use our practice to really get something from all of this? So I'll start out by talking about an experience I had a few days ago. Some of you may know that I've been gradually retiring from my many years as an ER doctor, but I kept going with one thing, and it was my work in this addiction clinic. So in this addiction clinic, we use a particular medication. It's aimed at opiate addicts, which is now a massive deadly epidemic throughout our country and perhaps a lot of other parts of the world, but especially our country. This is, in a sense, a black swan event. We didn't see it coming, we couldn't predict it, except for very few people initially. When I was taught 15, 20 years ago that pain is the fifth vital sign, and if you give an opiate to someone who genuinely has pain, they can't get addicted, etc., etc. There's a lot of money behind the browbeating of doctors to prescribe more and more of these medications. Because the companies that made these medications were standing to make billions of dollars, which they did, and bolstered by phony studies and outlandish claims like the one I just told you I was taught. So as a result, we created millions and millions of opiate addicts. And then when these medications were pulled from the market because we then learned that we were wrong, we were creating millions of addicts, the cost of these medications became very expensive and people would resort to heroin on the street. And this brought about just terrible, horrible outcomes, particularly in our own area right here. So this Pioneer Valley and along Route 91, it's called actually Heroin Highway. There's a traveling, a shipping of heroin from New York City up Route 91 all the way into Vermont, where all around the New England we have this problem. So 3 days ago, I actually went on in my training in order to directly care for patients. I wasn't doing that up till now. Over the past 2 years, I've been just simply prescribing and running group meetings, but now I want to find out a little bit more about one-on-one management of people in this circumstance, this crisis, how to manage them directly with this medication called Suboxone. So I went down to one of the clinics in Holyoke, Mass. Holyoke is an old mill town. Used to be, they call it Paper City. Used to have paper mills, and when they moved out, the economics of the area started to deteriorate, and people of lesser means began to live there because real estate was inexpensive. And it ended up being a place where many Hispanic people live now, Latinos. And it has all the problems of an inner city made up of folks who are treated somewhat differently by society, and now as a result of our recent Black Swan event, perhaps it'll get even much, much worse. So obviously drugs are a problem in societies like this, and it's a very, very big problem in Holyoke. So I went to this clinic, and I sat down with a superb, very experienced nurse practitioner who had been doing this work for about 9 years. She's actually one of the founders of this clinic. And our very first patient was a Hispanic lady in her late 20s who was an addict, addicted to pills, opiates. She was accompanied by a woman, maybe just a little older than her, someone in her mid-30s, who appeared very, very nice. Right away, I had a very good feeling about her. Apparently, she was her so-called home health aide, certified nursing assistant, spent 12 hours a day with this person who came in with a cane, taking care of her, watching over her, making sure that her health needs and her domestic needs were met. So in the conversation with both of these folks, I began to realize that the person who was helping this patient was an extraordinary human being. She told us a little bit about her life story. As I began to learn more about her, she was describing this heroin epidemic, this opiate epidemic, and the results of it, The fact that she would walk down the street and see people who were obviously seriously overdosed, who were not breathing, oftentimes filthy, maybe lying in their own vomit, or even worse, and how most people around this person would just look the other way or walk away or run away. And she could never do this. So she would go up to the person and try to wake them up, and she would carry with her this medication called Narcan and administer it and wake them up and then call 911, get them moving and save their lives. And she did this because she felt she had to do this. She didn't know why she had to, but she had to. She also told me that she would go out after a long day with this patient, go home and take care of her two children, one of whom has cerebral palsy, incidentally. And she's quite poor. She makes very little money as this nursing aide. And then at night would go out. She would cook some food and then go out with bags of food and go back from her home in Chicopee back into Holyoke, where she knew a lot of these addicts were homeless and other folks there were homeless, and bring them food. So as I started hearing her story, I realized I was sitting in the room here with this really, truly remarkable person. I wanted to find out how she got that way. So I asked her a couple of personal questions, which she seemed quite open to sharing. I said, how did you end up being like this? What was your, what were your parents like? What was your childhood like? She told me she had a wonderful mother, she loved so much and felt so loved by. But when she was 9 years old, her father murdered her mother. And her father got away scot-free and never had anything to do with her. So at 9 years old, she became an orphan and ended up in foster care. And in foster care, was beaten and raped many, many times. And then cut to the present. How amazing, unbelievable. I mean, talk about black swan events. Her life seemed to be a series of one after another. And yet, this was not a person in despair. This was not a person blaming her fate, feeling sorry for herself, although I'm sure much of the time she does. But something carried her through. It's just so remarkable, really remarkable. Once again, this koan that I just read, its moonlight is sort of very lightly illuminating this situation. So how unusual. So what is it about our practice that could explain this? Could explain this. What is it about it? So I'll go back to this koan again and just read it one more time. So this is the Diamond Sutra and Being Reviled. The Diamond Sutra says, one who is reviled by others has done wicked acts in former lifetimes, which doom him to fall into evil worlds. But because of the scorn and vilification by others in the present life, the transgressions in the former life are wiped out. If we suffer an adversity, such as having a misogynistic, racist, homophobic, narcissistic human being suddenly become our president, it is quite easy to blame the situation, blame others, blame the circumstances. And to some degree, it's true. there is blame to go around. It's easy to then lament our situation, to feel sorry for ourselves, to not know what the future is going to hold and be beset by anxiety, and then try to imagine it being different or fight against it or reject it or somehow fall into a depressed state over it. That did happen to a friend of mine who became very, very depressed after this election. And her husband said to her, "Why do you want to die twice? You're dying now over your thinking about the situation. You're going to die again when he becomes president. So just die once." I think it's actually kind of good advice. So what is this all about? Why did I bring this up? Why am I mentioning this in the context of what we're doing here? When we begin to entangle with, struggle against, fight, become despairing over a situation that is, it's very hard at that point to feel empowered, to be able to be in a clarity of the present moment in which the right thing to do will come to you, the right attitude, the right understanding. So when we're caught up with the reaction to a black swan event, we often fall into a groupthink and we do the wrong thing in that situation. What is this practice about then? What is it about? We are, in essence, utilizing the world of ever-changing forms to perceive something original, unchanging, in a sense, a perfection, in and through what appears so imperfect, so difficult, so wrong, so unfair. This is a critical aspect of our practice. So what we do is we assign people a practice like counting the breath or following the breath. And we instruct folks to allow their thoughts to flow through. Do not do battle with your thoughts. Simply maintain your focus on this practice, which is neutral, so that you can begin to allow it, see it in its actuality, as thoughts just pass through. They just pass through. They begin to become part of the actuality of your present moment. And through that, over a gradual period of time, something begins to shine from all of it. Something emanates from all of it. Something that was hidden behind our reactions, our fighting, our blaming, our feeling sorry for ourselves. So something shines through. What is it? It's hard to say, isn't it? So while I was sitting there in this room with this woman who, after she left, the instructor I was with and I began to refer to as Mother Teresa. It was obvious that there was something this person saw, something she saw. It was a certain kind of connection. It wasn't a running from, it wasn't a fighting against, it was a connection. So that this instructor of mine, after she left, said to me, "Paul, you've got to listen to this TED Talk. It's called The Opposite of Addiction is Connection." Connection. What does this mean, connection? So I want to read a little something here from the author of the Hekigan Roku, Yuan Wu. So this is a book of his letters called Zen Letters. And these are letters that he wrote to students of his. This is before email. Now we use email or texting. But back then, people would write letters, which is wonderful because they've been saved, and some of them are really quite amazing. But the very first letter in this book, I want to read you parts of this. So the letter goes like this. The title of it is, "If where you stand is reality, then your actions have power." If where you stand is reality, then your actions have power. So I'll read a little bit of this, and then I'll cut to the real essence of this letter, which is about 3 pages long. So Yuan Wu wrote, "Ever since antiquity, with excellence beyond measure, the saints and sages have experienced the great cause alone," that's capitalized, "great cause alone, as if planting great potential and capacity. By the power of their vows of compassion, they have brought forth direct indications of the," and this is again capitalized, "one thing that is most profound and most recondite," meaning hidden, in a funny way, hidden but not hidden, "most recondite, the common essence of all the myriad forms of being." The common essence of all the myriad forms of being. Remember what I said about the essential point of this Zazen practice. It's being able to, through an ever-changing series of forms, begin to see, like that little sliver moon in a dark night, something shining forth, something that isn't changing, something that is original, something that one might call the source or the perfection of the universe. So he goes on to say here, "Without setting up stages," that's important, "without setting up stages, like first I have to do this, then I have to do that, then I have to do that. Because there's a goal, there's a purpose, there's something I'm reaching for, and I'm never quite reaching it. Without setting up stages, they abruptly transcend to realize this essence alone. Since before the time when nothing existed, this essence has been ever still and unmoved, determining the basis of all conscious beings. It permeates all times and is beyond all thought. It is beyond holy and ordinary, and transcends all knowledge and views. It has never fluctuated or wavered. It is there, pure and naked and full of life. All beings, both animate and inanimate, have it complete within them." This one paragraph here perhaps says it all. Says it all. So our practice involves first penetrating into really what this is, and then illuminating, clarifying how to reconnect with this knowledge in all sorts of circumstances, both favorable and adverse, wonderful and black swan. That nothing can quite knock us off of this point when we really get it, when we really get it. So I'm going to move onward in this letter to kind of the essence of this. All right, so he says here, "Therefore, if where you stand is reality, then your actions have power. Needless to say, leading brave heroes, commanding fierce warriors, routing powerful bandits, comforting the farmers, pacifying the nation, and assisting the work of restoring social harmony and cultural fluorescence all depend on this one revelation." So think about this Mother Teresa that I met down in Holyoke, this unknown person who is really a true bodhisattva. Not even aware of being such herself. This is just, she can't do otherwise. So I'll read this one more time. "Therefore, if where you stand is reality, then then your actions have power. So this friend of mine who became very depressed and started throwing things around and became angry and why me, was this person when Donald Trump got elected standing in reality as Yuan Wu describes it here? How about the one that was orphaned at age 9, mother was killed by her father, was raped, physically abused, grew up in poverty, and lives in a poor community? Is she standing in reality? How do we do this? So I'll go back to the koan and we'll try to penetrate it a little bit and see if this helps us understand this better. So the Diamond Sutra and being reviled. So this chapter in the Diamond Sutra, or this section of the chapter, begins with, one who is reviled by others has done wicked acts in former lifetimes which doom him to fall into evil worlds. Is this someone we should feel sorry for? Is this someone outside? Someone we know? How well do we know this person? Do we know them really intimately? If we know this person intimately, can we embrace the circumstance? Can we see that although it seems to be a black swan event, couldn't be predicted, that the world is a world of cause and effect, that one thing leads to another, leads to another? And that at the time anything declares itself, at the time anything, whether we expected it or didn't expect it, whether we could predict it or couldn't predict it, whether it was wonderful or cataclysmic, at the moment we become aware of it, what is it? As I've said so many times, if nothing else, it is done and dusted. It is as it is. It is as it is. This is actually a description of mindfulness, isn't it? That things are what they are. That when we simply accept, even though we can't know the factors, that the way anything is right now is the only way it could possibly have been. That it was the end result of everything coming before. And as my wonderful teacher, Richard Clark, would always say, if it could have been one iota different, it would have been. If we learn nothing else from the practice of mindfulness, we learn this one thing. This is the starting point of our practice. This is where we begin. If it could have been one iota different, it would have been. Now, if you get that, when something like the black swan event that happened about 10 days ago happens, and you really get it, and you work on getting it, and you remind yourself every day for 10 minutes or 15 or 20 minutes or however long you do zazen, if you remind yourself that if it could have been one iota different, it would have been, and that when something appears to me, it's done, then are you going to fall into the state of reactivity that the average person might fall into? And then, if you don't, is it possible that your actions can have power? That starting with your feet planted in reality, the right course of action will come to you? The right attitude, the right so-called disposition? Remember the words of Dogen in Being Time? He said, man disposes himself and then takes that disposition to be the world. So that means that you and I develop an attitude towards a circumstance and then believe in the attitude, believe the attitude is actually reality. So we dispose ourselves and then take that to be the world, that we're right and everybody else is wrong. Things should have been this way, but they worked out that way. All the opinions we hear all day long from others. What if we didn't dispose ourselves? What if we simply planted our feet in reality? As Yuan Wu put it here, therefore, if where you stand is reality, then your actions have power. So, coming back to this, we often find ourselves in adverse circumstances. We may be criticized by others. We may be reviled by others. Think of this wonderful Mother Teresa type that I saw, who will have a president very soon, who calls people of her background rapists and murderers. Is she being reviled by others? Is that going to stop her, do you think? So then let's go to the second part of this, which is really the essence of it. This is the essence, and it's not what it appears. It's not what it appears. It appears to be kind of a grand scheme of retribution, that what goes around comes around, and that through your bad actions came, and that will make you change because then you'll never do it again, that kind of thing. Like George Bush, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, you'll never fool me again. So this second half goes like this. But because of the scorn and vilification by others in the present life, the transgressions in the former life are wiped out. This is the crux of this koan. Because of the scorn and vilification, because of the pain in my knee, because of the crash of the stock market, because of the election of a misogynistic narcissist, the transgressions of the former life are wiped out. How are they wiped out? How are they wiped out? Anything as it presents is done. Remember? It's done. If it's done, we don't have to fight it, struggle against it, contemplate why me, feel sorry for ourselves. Then what are we free to do at this point? What is this standing in reality empowers your actions? What are we free to do? We're free to see something about it rather than clinging, rejecting, or ignoring something. We're free to see what it is shining, what it is showing. It's fact. It's reality. There it is. It's the way it is. Now the next thing comes, and the next things. Step after step, mindfulness after mindfulness, no resistance, no antagonism to it, no ignoring it, just simply being with it as it is, understanding it could not have been different. Therefore, now I am free to be with its fact, be with its fact. This is the essence of Zazen, is being with the fact of our experience, being with the fact. The fact can't be explained. The fact is mysterious. The fact has no particularities. The fact is original. The fact was there before anything took shape. This is so-called Buddha nature. Mind with a capital M. The truth with a capital T. The one truth, as Yuan Wu puts it. The fact of the world. Its very presence. Its presence is not outside. Its presence depends upon me, so to speak. Its presence is in my deepest center. If it wasn't, it wouldn't be. So this is the beginning of wisdom, is to first embrace, accept, allow anything in the space of that presence to be as it is, because the presence is not harmed by it, it's not changed by it. And then our actions have power. So, gone a long time, and we'll end there now.